So in preparation for today's event, I read Chief Justice Rehnquist's majority opinion in Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, a 2002 case in which the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Ohio's pilot project scholarship program. At the time, the program gave tuition assistance to families in the Cleveland School District to attend public or private schools of their parents' choosing. Both religious and non-religious schools in the district could participate. Certain Ohio taxpayers sought to enjoin the program on the ground that it violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. The Supreme Court rejected that claim. Here is in part what the court said. Where a government aid program is neutral with respect to religion and provides assistance directly to a broad class of citizens who in turn direct government aid to religious schools wholly as a result of their own genuine and independent private choice, the program is not readily subject to challenge under the Establishment Clause. A program that shares these features permits government aid to reach religious institutions only by way of the deliberate choices of numerous individual recipients, the incidental advancement of a religious mission, or the perceived endorsement of a religious mission, is reasonably attributed to the individual recipient, not the government, whose role ends with the disbursement of benefits. This seems, at least to me, to be an entirely unexceptional and indeed common sense interpretation and understanding of the First Amendment, yet the case was decided on a 5-4 vote. Fast forward to today. On May 5, 2011, Governor Mitch Daniels signed the Indiana School Scholarship Act, which creates a school voucher program that has the broadest eligibility of any voucher program in the nation. In addition, the bill doubles the pre-existing cap on the scholarship tax credit program and creates a tax deduction for any family that pays out of pocket for educational expenses relating to private or home schools. This, too, seems to me to be a very sensible idea. Yet, of course, there are those who object, be it on constitutional grounds or policy reasons or both. Here today to help us sort through this controversy is Professor Richard Garnett. Professor Garnett teaches and writes about the freedoms of speech, association, and religion, and also about the constitutional and about constitutional law more generally. He does this at Notre Dame. He is a leading authority on questions and debates regarding the role of religious believers and beliefs in politics and society. Professor Garnett is closely involved with a number of efforts to improve and strengthen Catholic schools and to reform education policy more generally. He served on the Notre Dame Task Force on Catholic Education, is a fellow of the university's Institute for Educational Initiatives, is a founding associate of the American Center for School Choice, and consults regularly with the Alliance for Catholic Education. He also serves on the school board of the St. Joseph Grade School in South Bend. Please welcome Professor Garnett.
I have to say, I think the constitutional case for school choice was just made so succinctly and accurately that I'm tempted just to sit down and join you for dessert, but I suppose I have to earn Gene Meyer's money somehow. So I want to read to you just a little blurb that comes from Governor Daniels' signing statement about a month ago when he, as you just heard, signed into law what really is one of the most exciting and I think promising, even visionary, educational choice programs in the country. Here's what he said. "We must begin to honor the parents of Indiana. We must trust them and respect them enough to decide when, where, and how their children can receive the best education and therefore the best chance in life. For families that cannot find the right traditional public school or charter public school for their child and are not wealthy enough to move near one, justice requires that we help. Not just policy, not just efficiency, justice. We should let families apply the dollars that the state spends on their child to the non-government school of their choice." Again, hear, hear. And I can only hope that more of Governor Daniels' colleagues in other states follow his lead. Now, let me read something else to you. This is appropriate since we're Hoosier lawyers here in Indianapolis. This is from the late Milton Friedman. As you know, the Friedman Foundation, which is a leading advocate and sort of think tank engine for the school choice movement, is here in town. He proposed more than 50 years ago in an essay called The Role of Government in Education, that we should, quote, distinguish sharply between the financing of education and the operation of educational institutions. I hope we'll all keep that distinction in mind as we proceed today to discuss school choice. As he put it, his proposed reforms would, quote, center attention on the person rather than the institution. Government, preferably local governmental units, would give each child through his parents a specified sum to be used in paying for his general education. The parents would be free to spend this sum at a school of their own choice, provided it met certain minimum standards laid down by the appropriate public authority. Such schools would be conducted under a variety of auspices, by private enterprises operated for profit, by nonprofit institutions established by private endowment religious bodies, and some by government units. The result of these measures would be a sizable reduction in the direct activities of government, yet a great widening of the public educational opportunities open to our children. They would bring a healthy increase in the variety of educational institutions available and in competition among them. Private initiative and enterprise would quicken the pace of progress in this area, as it has in so many others. Government would serve its proper function of improving the operation of the invisible hand without substituting the dead hand of bureaucracy. Well, again, that's more than a half century ago, and one of the things we might discuss is how much progress we've made toward that vision. But again, I want to come back to this distinction that Friedman mentioned. If I could leave you with any one particular point to think about when you think about school choice, maybe something to put on a bumper sticker or a T-shirt, it would be this. Public education is the goal. Public schools are a delivery mechanism. What do I mean by that? It seems to me that what we should be trying to achieve through our education-related programs and policies and funding decisions is education for our children, for all of them. This is the target. This is what matters. This is what public education is, the education of the public. This goal can be achieved, as Dr. Friedman mentioned, in many different ways, through many different institutions, strategies, and programs. In other words, it can be achieved, this good can be achieved through many different delivery mechanisms. And the good itself, the education of children, the formation of good citizens, that good ought not to be confused with, as it so often is, with one particular delivery mechanism, namely what Governor Daniels called the traditional public school. Well, hold that thought. So you just heard about the Zelman case. It's been more or less a decade since that decision when my old boss, God bless him, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, upheld Ohio's pioneering school choice program. And in many ways, it really was appropriate that that decision was written by Chief Justice Rehnquist. When he came on the court in the early 1970s, the justices, it's fair to say, were in the grip of some confusion on these matters. He came on to a court that was deciding cases, and you know, you all remember these names from law school, cases like Lemon and Nyquist, which were characterized, I think it's fair to say, by a great amount of skepticism, even hostility, toward the very mission of private schools, particularly parochial schools. There was a sense at that time, it was the received wisdom, that the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment placed a barrier, maybe a very, maybe an insuperable barrier, to efforts by local governments, and there were lots of efforts, to try to support with public funds the very public good work that parochial schools were often doing. But over time, in case after case, as the years went by, Rehnquist was often leading the way in deciding cases and in subtly shifting precedents in such a way that the rule changed. The received wisdom has been revised. And now I think it's fair to say, I think it's pretty much non-controversial, really, that a sensibly designed school choice program that includes qualifying religious schools is entirely constitutional. Zelman held that. Again, it was a 5-4 decision, but I do think that the basic principle there, that because private schools, including religious schools, do provide a public secular good, they educate kids, it's not required by the Establishment Clause that we exclude them from the coverage of a general education program. So like I said, that was about a decade ago. But it's been about 13 years, 14 years, since Wisconsin's Supreme Court rejected a similar Establishment Clause challenge to the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. I want to go back sort of behind Zelman to the Milwaukee case for a couple reasons, some personal and some that are relevant to our topic. As you might have noticed, I think this event was advertised as being about school choice and the Constitution's plural. One of the things I'm going to try to suggest for your consideration today is that the real fight in the school choice battle these days isn't so much about the meaning or application of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment as it is about the various intricacies of lots of state constitutional provisions, and I think that's true in Indiana as well. So I remember the day very well when this Wisconsin case was decided. My wife and I were in Spain, and she had been one of the lawyers working for a merry band of libertarian lawyers called the Institute for Justice, one of the lawyers defending in court the Milwaukee program. And we're sitting there in some cafe having wine, I assume, right across from that city's cathedral, and we're kind of flipping through the Herald Tribune, and suddenly my wife, very emotional, says, "Oh my God," and starts crying. Well, and good husband that I am, I immediately asked what was wrong. People around are assuming that, like, she's just, maybe she got an obscene Twitter message about me, I don't know. She handed me the section she was reading, which included the good news about the Wisconsin court's decision. It was a wonderful day, 14 years ago. What's happened in the interim? How well are we doing in making good on the opportunity that that case opened up for us? The road to Zelman, and now the road since Zelman, has been a long one. And although that case did remove, as you've heard, one barrier to choice-based education reform, it didn't end the debate. Obviously, in Indiana, we know that. The debate not only in courtrooms and law school classrooms, but in corporate boardrooms, legislative chambers, and, of course, in the court of public opinion. And I'm proud to say, for what it's worth, that the University of Notre Dame, particularly the Alliance for Catholic Education, has really embraced, in a way that to me is very refreshing and inspiring, the importance of school choice. So in my view, choice programs like the one we have now in Indiana, like the one that was upheld in Ohio, like the one that was recently brought back to life, thanks to Speaker Boehner in D.C., after Congress unceremoniously killed it. These policies are sound. They make sense. They're good fiscally. They're good in terms of efficiency and competition. But most importantly, they're good in terms of basic justice and the common good. In other words, these programs help us to achieve our goal of public education, and they do so precisely because they don't make the mistake of confusing public education with the monopoly of government-run schools. In my view, school choice is best regarded, best framed, best discussed as a moral question, as an issue of basic justice and civil rights, as a crucial aspect of parents' responsibility and parents' vocation, their calling, to direct the education and the formation of their children. And again, I think Governor Daniels did a great job of putting it in those terms. So one of the things I've noticed in litigating school choice cases, teaching this stuff, arguing about it, is that we often ask what I think are the wrong questions and don't focus enough on the right ones. I'm going to try to distinguish the right questions from the wrong questions in my time today. It seems that three main questions have tended to dominate the debate about school choice. First, are school vouchers constitutional, or does school choice violate the separation of church and state that is supposedly required by the First Amendment? Second question, would school choice work? And of course, then we can have a discussion about what it would mean for school choice to work. But these are the kinds of things that occupy, you know, educational sociologists in a number of countries of all types, and every couple days you'll read in the newspaper some new study has found a blip or an uptick in a reading score, or perhaps a slight dip in a math score. This argument, I suspect, will continue as long as the debate about choice goes on. Third, and this is a little bit more general, there are questions about whether the possible benefits of choice to children are outweighed by what some see as the social or political costs of school choice. And what are those costs? Well, they're asserted to be, among other things, that school choice would divide us rather than bring us together, because the claim is that our system of public schools has done a great job of taking kids from different backgrounds, different walks of life, and educating them in a common context in a way that helps to form good citizens. That's an important debate to have, I think. As I'm going to suggest to you today, in my view, the best arguments and the best evidence suggests that if what you really care about are public-minded, virtuous, other-regarding citizens, your best bet is probably to put them in private schools rather than public schools. I could talk for a long time, but I promise I won't, about the actual legal doctrines here, but I think I probably should say a little bit about it. And I hope those of you who know this stuff already will forgive me if it's old news. As you just heard, as I mentioned, the leading Supreme Court case right now on the Establishment Clause question is this case called Zelman. And in a nutshell, the rule is that it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause for the government to spend money to purchase a public good, right? That's a secular purpose. What is that public good here? It's education. It doesn't violate the Establishment Clause for the government to say, we are going to subsidize the production and consumption of that public good, and we don't really care whether the people who are consuming it or producing it are doing so in a religious context. The idea is that the government is not establishing or even really directly supporting religion. Rather, it is supporting the production and consumption of this very important secular public good. That's where we are now. Now, there are going to be lots of institutional design questions about different voucher programs in different states. The Zelman case that you've heard about got the justices involved in sort of hinting that, you know, maybe there would be some voucher programs that were set up in such a way that they were constitutionally troubling. So you could imagine a voucher program that, you know, you can't really imagine this ever being enacted, but I'm a law school professor, so I can imagine all kinds of silly things. You know, a voucher program that said, here's the deal, we're big fans of school choice, and so kids can use vouchers, but only at Methodist schools. Well, obviously, that's not going to be constitutional right. That's not going to get enacted either. The basic structure that we see in school choice programs across the country operates as a scholarship. Some eligibility criteria are set out. Kids who meet that eligibility criteria are given some kind of a scholarship check, or perhaps a voucher, or perhaps it's just a direct deposit, whatever. But the money follows the kid. The kid makes a choice of where they want to go to school. The school usually has to qualify in some way. Indiana has a kind of endearing little provision that schools that advocate the overthrow of the government can't participate. Fair enough. Sometimes the eligibility criteria are a little trickier, like about non-discrimination in admissions. So some schools that for whom it's important to keep more control over their admissions criteria might choose not to participate in school choice. The schools I'm most involved in, the parochial schools, this doesn't end up being a problem for us. Indiana's law, by the way, is actually very generous and makes it quite clear that private schools and religious schools are allowed to continue using their standard admissions criteria, so long as they don't discriminate on the basis of race. But again, these schools don't have any interest in discriminating on the basis of race. So you've got eligible kids, eligible schools, the money follows the one to the other. That's the basic model, and that model is consistent with the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Well, I said constitutions. Now, one of the things about the school choice movement, or fight, if you want to call it that, is that over the last 15 years or so, those who oppose school choice have decided to fight on the ground of state constitutional restrictions on funding of religious purposes rather than federal ones. So I was involved a little bit in the litigation about the Florida school choice program, which was sort of the brainchild of many people, including Governor Jeb Bush. It was a fabulous program. It was statewide. It was now that it was almost as good as Indiana's. But it was invalidated by Florida's kangaroo Supreme Court on the grounds that it violated certain, I thought, relatively arcane provisions of that state's constitution. These state constitutional provisions come in a number of different forms. Some of them are pretty straightforward. They're like state versions of the Establishment Clause, and Indiana has a couple provisions that you could say look like that. Some other provisions that creative school choice opponents have seized on have to do with things like requirements in the state constitution that the state set up and maintain. Usually it's worded something like this, a uniform system of common schools or a uniform system of public schools. Indiana uses that word, uniform. That was the rock that sunk the Florida program, if you want. Now, I guess I'm not an expert on the state constitutional law of all 50 states. My sense is that the viability of school choice programs on state constitutional grounds is going to vary a lot from state to state. Arizona interpreted its own constitution in a way that basically puts it on the same page as the federal rules, which means Arizona is very friendly to school choice. Florida, as you've heard, has not done that. So what will Indiana do? Well, I say this knowing full well that most of you in this room know Indiana constitutional law better than I do. But my own reading of what precedents there are, and there really aren't many, actually makes me think that the environment's pretty favorable here on state constitutional grounds, too. It seems to me that those provisions of the Indiana Constitution dealing with the question of funding and religious institutions have been and would be interpreted kind of like the Supreme Court interpreted the Establishment Clause in Zelman, and therefore it really shouldn't be a problem. As for the provision that requires a uniform system of common schools, again, what precedents there are suggests that the Supreme Court here is not interested in excessive activism in enforcing that uniformity clause. So my own view is that the new school choice bill here in Indiana will be given a chance to work. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing that the question, should we experiment with school choice and try to be more creative with delivery mechanisms for helping our children become good citizens, it's a good thing if that debate isn't determined entirely in the context of litigation. It's a good thing that it is determined in the context of politics, conversation, arguments, and legislation. That's where we are, I hope, going forward. So, as I mentioned, the second main question that people ask about school choice is whether it will work. If the first one is whether it's constitutionally permissible, I think our answer at both the state and the federal level is yes. You know, put an asterisk depending on how it's designed. Second question, will it work? I don't know. It would be easy for me to sort of play the part of the teachers' unions, researchers for hires, and say, aha, I can prove to you that it won't work. One tricky little thing is it's kind of hard to know whether something would work if it hasn't been tried. And those who oppose school choice have so often been successful in preventing the enactment of school choice programs that I have to admit it always strikes me as a little disingenuous when they say, oh, and these things haven't been proven to work. Well, let us try. Give us a shot. Right? My sense of the research, for what it's worth, is that, in fact, you don't see dramatic, huge gains in reading scores or math scores or anything like that when kids are able to use a voucher to leave a bad public school and go to a better parochial or private school. Right? They're not dramatic, but they're usually there. Right? Maybe small, but there. And then my question is, well, let's say it's a wash. Then isn't that a good thing? The parent is getting to send the kid to a school they prefer. The product the government cares about paying for, i.e. education, is just as good as the one that they were getting in the public school. But now they're happier. The parents have been empowered. They've put their kid in an environment that they think is better for their kid. Odds are of a parent who's made that decision is going to be more closely involved and engaged with their child's education. This is a good thing. Right? So even if, I mean, file this away, even if it were true, and I'm not conceding that it is, that the outputs were the same, why would that be an argument against school choice? Especially when, remember, these schools are delivering the product for a third of the cost. In my town, my kids' tuition at St. Joe Grade School is about a third of what it costs to educate a kid in the South Bend community schools. So even if it were true, and actually the scores in my kids' school tend to be a lot better, but even if it were a flat line, even if it were even Steven, they're doing it for a third of the cost. I would think that as good stewards of the public money, we'd say, if the product's just as good, let's let the folks who can produce it more cheaply have a shot at doing it. Here's another part of the does it work question that I think needs to be on the table. Even if it's true that you don't see dramatic changes in test scores and so on, one thing we have learned, especially from the DC program and the Milwaukee program, is that graduation rates skyrocket. Right? Now, why is this? I got two theories. One theory, I really do believe that people who've been empowered by school choice programs, that empowerment has effects downstream in the sense that they are more likely to finish the race. They feel like agents. They feel like maybe there's a point to sticking this out. Right? Because I was trusted by my community with the ability to choose my own school for my own kid. Right? I think that's part of what's going on. Also part of what's going on, though, is that a lot of times, many times, these schools, these maybe mission-oriented private schools, whether they be religious or non-religious, they just simply do a better job of creating an environment that makes the families, makes the children want to stay for the long haul. So the graduation rate point is something, again, I hope you'll all keep in mind whenever you read, like, oh, the test scores didn't go up. Maybe not. But it strikes me that for the long-term success of low-income kids, it's a heck of a lot more important that they graduate from high school than that their ISTEP scores blipped up a little bit. What about, then, the third set of questions? These are, in my view, the most important now. Right? The constitutional ones, I think, are pretty settled. I mean, we'll have to keep on litigating them. This will be a pain, but I think they are pretty settled. With the will it work question, my position is basically, let's call it a draw. Right? Even if it's even, let's give it a shot. Right? I mean, since when do we just on principle prefer monopoly and stasis over innovation and competition? Right? Why would we do that? So then the real question is, what if there are costs to these choice experiments, costs to our values, that outweigh whatever benefits we think they might bring? I don't think there are, but I think it's important to take seriously the claim that they are. Now, what are the benefits then? Well, I've sketched out a few of them. I mean, one benefit would be that you're getting a better product, right? High graduation rates. There's a lot of studies showing that kids who come out of private and parochial schools are often more sort of engaged in current affairs and more other regarding, volunteer more, all this kind of stuff. So you're getting a pretty good product at a reduced price. You're telling your citizens, we trust you. That has positive downstream effects. I suppose maybe in this room you'll forgive me if I say it's, to me, it's kind of a benefit if you reduce the monopoly power of the teacher unions, which I think is excessive. But to be fair, what are the downside risks? As I said, the one that you hear most often is that school choice is divisive. Right? I remember when I used to litigate this stuff more when I was a real lawyer, there'd always be this kind of, I thought it was a red herring, but the red flag that was waved is, what about the jihadi school that starts up? Are we really going to have funds, public funds, going to schools that teach, you know, this kind of hatred and so on? Well, in Indiana, apparently not, right? better not advocate the overthrow of the government. But I want to push back on that narrative even more. And again, I hope, this in a sense, I'm returning to my theme of the distinction between the good and the mechanism. I don't want to be heard by any of you, especially since it's being recorded, to be criticizing in a general way the idea of public education. Obviously, I'm not. That would be wrong. But
Strike that from the record.
Yes, sir. But, you know, as good critical thinkers, we ought to be able and willing to point out that the story of the founding and the development of public education in America is not entirely a happy one or a division-free one itself, right? I mean, the public schools in this country as an institution for a long time explicitly had, and then later implicitly had, a fairly aggressive indoctrination mission, right? The idea was to take the children of immigrants, Jewish and Catholic immigrants in particular, and turn them into better Americans. How to do that? By making them more Protestant. The theory was that these Catholic schools that were cropping up in all of our cities were teaching kids to be disloyal to America, right? To not be good citizens, to have divided loyalties, perhaps to a guy in a pointy hat over in Rome. This sounds kind of weird and outdated or maybe even conspiracy-ish to you today, because I think for the most part that aspect of the debate is gone. But well into the 20th century, a leading reason why people opposed the public funding or the public support of the work of parochial schools was connected with a deep and pervasive anti-Catholicism that's been a part of this country's history for a long time. And I like to think, maybe I'm naive, that we've largely moved beyond most dimensions of that. But, you know, when I hear these kind of romanticized accounts of our public schools and how school choice is such a threat to it, I want to say, just remember, these parochial schools have been operating alongside public schools, often in the face of hostility, for a long time. They've provided hundreds of billions, with a B, worth of public benefit to this country without much public support. And the product's been a good one, and they've done this in the face of this kind of repeated, in my view, unfounded and unworthy attack that they were somehow dividing children, creating bad citizens, introducing discord into the social fabric. Justice Felix Frankfurter, who's obviously a brilliant man, in his decisions about the Establishment Clause, a half century ago, he was quite explicit about this theme, right? That public education was about homogenization, and that parochial schools, particularly Catholic schools in his view, were a threat to the country precisely because they made more likely that kids would be aware of differences among themselves. So I'm not endorsing balkanization or division or discord by any stretch, but I do think we ought to remember that, in fact, despite all this scaremongering, these schools have produced a good, quote-unquote, product. They have produced good citizens. They've produced a public good that they can now, in justice, say to us, you know what, you, the citizens, the taxpayers, probably should have to pay us a little bit for this. Right? Again, we're producing something that you are using at a cheaper price than you are able to do. Now, I'm confident that giving parents the ability to exercise meaningfully their moral and constitutional right to educate their children as they see fit will improve public education, properly understood. I mean, I do believe that, as Friedman did, that there's a lot to this idea that introducing competition into the education marketplace will help that marketplace function better all around. But I admit, I can't be sure how that will happen, how quickly it will happen. Right? I can't promise anybody that it'll be cost-free. But at the end of the day, for me, this third set of questions about benefits and costs boils down to the fact that the case for school choice is, I think as Governor Daniels suggested, it's a moral one. I believe it is unjust for us as a policy matter to tolerate a situation where children who don't have opportunities that we take for granted that our children do have, right, are told, you have to stay in an underperforming public school while I can move to a district with better public schools, can afford to send my kid to a private school, can afford to send my kid to a parochial school, and so on. And the reason you have to stay in that school is because if we let you leave, the schools will get even worse. That's a hostage-taking argument, and usually we don't think hostage-taking arguments are all that weighty, right? There is no clause in the Constitution, state or federal, that says any policy which increases the risk that a particular government institution will function less well is unconstitutional. Right? We ought to be unsympathetic to hostage-taking arguments. The argument, we need your kid in this failing school, parenthesis, that my kids won't go to, but we need your kid in this failing school so that those failing schools won't get even worse, that is not, in my view, an attractive or plausible moral argument. Right? The argument has to be, at the very least, if you're going to tell these kids they have to stay in those schools, you have to be committed to making them better. But it seems to me that in every other context, in our, praise God, free country, our inclination is to say, if you think you have a better way, if you think you can choose a better path for yourself to help yourself and your family to flourish better, so long as you're not, harming others, go for it. That's kind of the freedom thing, and I'm for it. I think, again, it's appropriate here in Indianapolis that I'm for it. I think I might stop there. I was told to try to leave 20, 15 minutes or so for questions, and I think we have that much time left. If I could just return full circle, though, to the point I started off with, which I hope doesn't come across as sort of too cliche or cutesy. I think it is an important point, is that the case for school choice is not a case against public education. Right? It's a case for public education achieved through a broader range of delivery mechanisms. And the claim is that broader range will help us to achieve the good in more cases, more cheaply, and that will not only help our country, but be more just, especially to the most vulnerable among us. So thank you.